Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Bob McDonald. Welcome to Quirks and Quarks. On this week's show, nature's nurturing side. A new study shows disabled primates can be supported by their family and community.
We grow up learning that it is survival of the fittest. We see that there is documented presence of survival and even reproduction of primates with physical impairments.
And they see with sound and feel with electricity. Dolphins have an electroreceptive sense.
When a dolphin starts digging and can't use echolocation anymore and doesn't see anymore, electroreception might come in handy to give them the last very important hint on where to successfully catch the fish.
Plus, beetles carry dinosaur feathers into amber, jellyfish can learn without a brain, and how the northern penguin led to the invention of extinction. All this today on Quirks and Quarks. Wild primates, like monkeys and apes, are our closest living relatives. And much like humans, they rely on their communities for support when they need it. But that support might go farther than some might have thought. A new study by researchers from Concordia University looked at primates that are disabled in some way and how they were able to manage in the wild. What they found was that whether they were born with a malformation or injured later on in life, primates were able to not only survive, but thrive, as long as they had the support of others, mainly moms. Brogan Stewart, a PhD candidate in environmental science at Concordia University in Montreal, was part of the team. Ms. Stewart, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
Which primates did you include in your study?
So for this study, it's actually a global scale analysis. We did a systematic review of all of the primate literature, so all non-human primates.
So what's that include?
Apes and great apes. So it'd be like chimpanzees, gorillas, orangutans, and then monkeys, so different macaques, capuchins, howler monkeys, and then also prosimians, so lemurs, tarsiers, all primates.
Boy, there's a whole civilization out there of primates.
Yeah.
What types of disabilities did you see in these animals?
We found that there were malformations. So typically, the primates are born with malformations. So this could be like a limb malformation, for instance. We also found that there were injuries. There were disabilities from illnesses. There was neurological conditions as well.
So when you say malformations, you mean like maybe born with a deformed hand, or what do you mean by that?
For instance, the field site that I specifically work at is in Japan. And in this field site, there are monkeys born with malformations. So it can be fused fingers. So their fingers could be fused together. It can be missing fingers or missing toes, but it can also extend to missing hands and missing feet.
So these are long-term disabilities we're talking about here.
Yes, exactly. So some of the monkeys that I work with, they're born with them, but then they'll live to be about 30 years old.
Now, what about animals that were injured later in life?
What we found in our review is that can be from a bunch of different things. It could be from aggression amongst group members. It could be from falling. It could be from predation. So they could be missing their tails, even an ear or an eye.
Now, how many of those injuries were human-related?
So that was one of the really interesting results from our study. 60% of these can be possibly or connected to human activities. So this really suggests an entangled relationship among humans, the environment, and primate disability.
What kind of injuries were they suffering from humans?
Some of the malformations can be attributed to humans. So it could be from toxic agents in the environment, like agrochemicals. We saw gunshot wounds. We saw power line burns. We also saw a lot of snare trap injuries. So what happens in, let's say, some places in Africa is People will set up snare traps in order to catch other game meat to feed their families. But then chimpanzees, for instance, will accidentally get caught in these traps and can cripple their hands and feet.
So what did you learn in your study about how primates are able to get along and survive despite these disabilities?
That's a great question. So we found that many primate species and individuals can adjust their behaviors and live with these physical impairments. So within our study, 64% of the articles describe primates using behavioral flexibility. And behavioral flexibility is the ability to adjust behavior according to circumstance and need. And then we also found that 19% described some sort of innovation within the groups. Then 33% of the articles described maternal care, and 14% described some version of care from other group members.
Okay, so I can understand adaptation. I mean, anyone who has a malformation just learns how to work with that. But what about the social interactions? How were the primates helping each other or helping the disabled one to survive?
We found that the disabled infants tended to be more tolerated by group members. So a disabled infant could actually feed in closer proximity to higher ranking monkeys within the group, and it was more tolerated. Or they'd even be able to kind of walk on other monkeys where non-disabled infants wouldn't be allowed to do that.
Well, taking care of an infant is one thing, but what happens when that infant grows up and it's still got that disability?
There was an instance of a wild chimpanzee mother who had slight hand malformations, and she had a disabled daughter who was 7 years old, and her daughter couldn't use her legs. Her legs couldn't stretch out properly, and she wasn't able to walk on them. She was 7 years old, this daughter, and how she would get around mostly was in the trees. So she would spend most of her time in the trees using her arms so that she didn't need to use her legs. But then when the group was traveling and they'd reach a spot where she could no longer continue in the trees and would have to use the ground, then her mother would carry her 7-year-old daughter on her back during those times. And this was in Guinea in West Africa.
Was there any case where the individuals that were disabled were rejected by the group?
Yeah, so we tend to have a narrow view of nature where the expectation is that natural selection will always operate tightly on an individual's every physical characteristic and feature. For instance, I know I did. We grow up learning that it is survival of the fittest. And following that mentality, that would mean that a physically impaired animal would not survive in the wild. However, from our review, we see that there is documented presence of survival and even reproduction of primates with physical impairments. So this raised a lot of questions about their behavioral ecology and their ability to adapt when facing these challenges. That being said, I'm not saying that every physical impaired primate survives, but it was fascinating reading about the ones that were able to.
So what was the most surprising takeaway for you from this study?
I think that there are two main takeaways, I'd say. So these results could be seen as an additional warning of the imposed challenges, but also just negative consequences that humans are having on animals. Not only are humans causing animal populations to decline, but the fact that we found that 60% of the research articles possibly or confirmed disability to be linked to human-induced changes, it's alarming, and it demonstrates additional repercussions of human pressures. So with that, like, I think about the growing human population with climate change, with the continued habitat loss for many primates, I think these results will likely continue or become worse. But then I think that there's another takeaway that can come from this study, and that's that primates can be incredibly resilient. And this is a testament to their intelligence, to living in the social groups, and their ability to compensate behaviorally. It's incredibly fascinating to see how primates are able to survive and adapt to physical challenges, but also to environmental change. So I guess this gives me some hope for the future, that, you know, many primate species could be resilient in the face of human-induced environmental changes.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just interesting that the primate social organization is tolerant to those who are disabled, and that they have a way of fighting back against the pressures that are against them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. They can be incredibly resilient.
Ms. Stewart, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Brogan Stewart is a PhD candidate in environmental science at Concordia University. Amber is amazing stuff. It's beautiful, of course, which is why it's being used for jewelry back into antiquity. But for paleontologists, amber can also be a time capsule. It's fossilized tree sap and can be tens or hundreds of millions of years old. And plants and animals can be captured in it when it's sticky and fresh, and thus be preserved through the eons when it hardens. Scientists have found ants locked in mortal combat from millions of years ago, or a tiny flowering plant unknown today, but perfectly preserved to offer clues about ancient vegetation and even climate from another time. Now, amber is telling stories about how animals live together. A case in point are the recently described fossils that are showing the relationship between a dinosaur and a beetle. Dr. Ricardo Perez de la Fuente, deputy head of research at Oxford University Museum of Natural History, and his colleagues studied this 105-million-year-old fragment of amber. Dr. Perez de la Fuente, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thanks so much, Bob. It's a pleasure.
Well, describe this piece of amber that you've studied. What's it like?
Yeah, so these are small fragments of amber that were found in northeastern Spain in a locality that we call San Just. And these amber fragments have contained inside molds that is cast of skin, so to speak, of beetles. And these cast of skins are surrounded by portions of downy feathers.
Wow, feathers and beetles. Now the piece of amber itself, how big is it if I was to hold it in my hand?
So these are very tiny fragments. We're talking about basically half a centimeter. So really, really, really tiny. Basically, much smaller than our nails. And so the challenge here is basically attempting to reconstruct the past, right, based on such a tiny windows that allows us to take a glimpse into how life was more than 100 million years ago.
Well, tell me about the beetle that's in the amber.
Yeah, so these beetles, the molds of the beetle species that we have were from an immature, from a larval beetle. And turns out that the closest relatives to which we've been able to identify the fossils are skin or carpet beetles. Now, it's very interesting since today these skin beetles, aside from feeding on being pests, in collections of dry materials. In the natural environment, they're also common inhabitants of nests, particularly those of mammals and birds. And in those nests, these beetles, they feed on feathers or hair.
What are they getting out of the feather and hair?
Well, they actually are able to obtain food out of the feathers and hair. Now, feathers and hair are made up of mostly keratin. Keratin is a protein that is super difficult to digest for most organisms. But a few organisms have actually specialized in feeding and extracting, therefore, energy from the feathers and the hair. And therefore, they live out of these products.
Okay, so those are the beetles today. You found this one in amber from 100 million years ago. Where did the feathers come from?
The feathers are also preserved in the same amber piece. And those feathers were at some point, we believe, based on our evidence, they were detached from the theropod host. That is a type of dinosaur that had feathers. Now, some Cretaceous dinosaurs had feathers. So in our case, though, in our fossil, we have downy feathers, but we are not able to identify to which theropod dinosaur they belong, since actually their shape, their form, their morphology, as we call them, is very generic. One thing is for certain, though, Bob, turns out that theropod hosts from that had our feathers were not modern birds, because according to the current evidence, modern birds appeared much later in the fossil record, about 1,700 million years ago, whereas our fossils are 105 million years old. And the size of feathers actually is not necessarily gives information on the host size.
Huh. Now, amber comes from tree resin. So how did the beetle larva and the dinosaur feathers actually get together?
Yeah, that's a good question. At some point, well, the way we reconstruct how our fossil assemblage, as we call it, got trapped in resin is that the feathers were accumulated and they were detached from the host and then accumulating. And then the beetles were actually living in or on them, feeding on those feathers. Now, it turns out that we have some evidence of a certain decay having occurred in the amber piece. Some of the molds are actually accompanied by feces, little feces that we think they belong to the beetles. We also have some fungi having grown in the whole assemblage, those remains, right, accumulated. So that's the way we picture it. One of the possible scenarios, actually, is that feather accumulation had been taken place in a nest setting.
Oh, the dinosaur had a nest in the tree, and that's where the larva was living in the nest.
That's actually a possibility. Also taking into account that modern domestic beetles also have such environments, right, in which way they develop.
So does that mean that the feather was not necessarily on the dinosaur?
Exactly. So that's actually the way we reconstruct the whole picture.
So what was it like for you to be able to uncover this relationship between a beetle larva and a dinosaur, a feathered dinosaur from so long ago?
Well, it's always amazing, right, to take part in these sorts of discoveries. And it's always exciting, even finding feathers preserved in amber. They're not that abundant. But when actually my colleague and first author of the study found these remains, and then he told me about it, he was absolutely in shock because, finding evidence of interaction, right, between two organisms in deep time is incredibly rare. And so it's always super exciting to be part of these discoveries. And I can never get used to these things.
You really captured a moment in time.
Absolutely. And in a way, it's something that even we paleontologists should not be taken for granted, right? The fact that for more than 100 million years, there was this substance, resin, later amber, that is able to capture organisms or their parts and preserve them with incredible detail. And also, essentially, it's resin and amber is able to capture or transport in time bits of the ecosystem. So, it's incredible.
Dr. Perez de la Fuente, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Bob. That was a pleasure.
Dr. Ricardo Perez de la Fuente is the Deputy Head of Research at Oxford University Museum of Natural History. Brains are a double-edged sword. On the one hand, they're enormously useful. We can use them to learn and remember, innovate and problem solve. So, by and large, brains have to be considered a good thing. But it turns out they're not a necessary thing, even for complex behaviors like learning and memory. That's what a team, including Jan Bielecki, found in a new study of a brainless animal, the box jellyfish. Dr. Bielecki is a biologist at Kiel University in Germany. Hello and welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you so much, and thank you very much for the kind introduction.
So let's begin with the Caribbean box jellyfish. What's it like?
Well, it's one of the smaller one of the class. It's about 10 millimeters in bell diameter, so it's about the size of a pinky nail, and it has tentacles of about an inch, I'd say. It has 24 eyes situated on four eye brain structures called ropalia. So each of these ropalia have six eyes, and two of those eyes are lens eyes, like human eyes, basically, with lenses and retinas and even irises. And these animals are found in the Caribbean, in these mangrove lagoons, where they live in and among the mangrove roots under the canopy of the mangrove trees.
How do they live in that environment?
That's the tricky part, because it's a kind of a love-hate relationship between them and the mangrove roots, because they hunt for prey in these light shafts created by the sun shining through the foliage and in between the prop roots. The problem is that it's a dangerous environment for them, because the animals have a very fragile epidermis, so if they collide with the prop roots, then they risk damage to their bell, and it can cause infections, and they will die. So they're searching for these light shafts, and they also have to avoid the roots. So they have this behavior that we also described in the paper, that they judge distance underwater by the contrast between an obstacle and the surrounding water. And when it's a very high contrast, the object is close, and when it's a low contrast, the object is far away and considered not dangerous to the animal. So to optimize the time spent foraging in the light shafts, they will judge the distance and when it's safe to maneuver. If the contrast of these prop roots are getting too high, then they will avoid them and maneuver around them, yes.
Now, the jellyfish are known to not have a brain, so what evidence is there that there's learning and memory going on in this environment?
Well, that's what we've been testing. I know it sounds intriguing that they don't have a brain, but they don't have a centralized brain. And they have condensed neurons in four Ruppelial structures. They are, I used to refer to them as eye brain structures, because this is where the eyes are located. And in these condensed form of neurons, they process visual information, and this is also, we found, the learning center. However, there was a meeting of some very, very important professors once in Germany. They sat down and argued amongst themselves, and they found that cnidarians do not have brain, per definition. So I guess we could refer to them as brainless. I have to say, though, that the jellyfish don't care what German professors tell them.
Okay. Well, take me through your experiment. What did you do to try to find out how they're using these neurons to learn and memorize their environment?
Well, like I mentioned, they have this way of gauging distance underwater by the contrast of the object. The problem with that is that the contrast relationship is not always the same, because some days the water is turbid and maybe the sediment got stirred up. So we knew that they had to adjust for this these problems in their habitat. So we were almost certain that they had to learn this, and there was a system in place where they could learn this. And that's why we designed these experiments, to test it, if that was really the case. And we did it by putting it in a behavioral arena. That's a fancy way to say bucket, where we had gray and white stripes on the side. And to the animals, they have lens eyes with spatial vision, but the resolution is not as great as our eyes, obviously. So to them, a vertical bar is a perfect rendering of a mangrove prop root. They wouldn't be able to tell the difference. So if we put them in this behavioral arena with these gray bars, then they would think this is a prop root, but it's so far away I can ignore it. But after a couple of tries where they bumped their bell into the side of the tank, they learned that, oh, today is apparently a turbid day, so these prop roots are much, much closer than they appear to be. And we actually saw that within the duration of the experiment, 7.5 minutes, they performed better in all the parameters that we measured to describe this obstacle avoidance behavior. Distance to wall, a lower number of contacts, they stayed generally further away from the wall after they learned.
Wow. And they learned that in 7.5 minutes. Were you surprised that they were able to learn so quickly?
Absolutely. That's the surprise to us, actually. We had no doubt that they could learn, but we were surprised how fast they learned. So the ability to learn, it's an integral function of a neuron, is our hypothesis now. And reaching these very few cells in the Ruppelium means that we could actually pinpoint these cells, sort of like the golden cell at the end of the motor neuron rainbow, that we can now target to try to understand the mechanisms of learning in single cells. And that would be very interesting to see.
Well, do you think we could take a lesson from these jellyfish who are learning with so few neurons and apply that to robotics and try to simplify how they think?
That's I'm glad you asked that question, because that's actually what we're doing. I'm working together with engineers and material scientists, and we're trying to copy the jellyfish nervous system onto a chip so that we can achieve pattern recognition in hardware and not as it is.
Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
Now it's in software. It could be that we could achieve this pattern recognition in hardware, and by that drastically reducing the power consumption of such a device.
Wow. Dr. Bielecki, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Jan Bielecki is a biologist at Kiel University in Germany. I'm Bob McDonald, and you're listening to Quirks and Quarks on CBC Radio 1. Coming up later in the show, The Invention of Extinction. A new book traces the end days of the great auk.
There were three men who went on shore, and they got the two birds and one egg. And these were the last killings in Iceland after the killings elsewhere on Newfoundland and Scottish Isles, etc.
It might surprise you to learn that baby dolphins are born with facial hair. It's not a full beard, just a couple of rows of whiskers on their beak-like snouts. And most dolphins lose that hair soon after birth, leaving just a few cute little dimples where the hair had been. But the dimples are more than cute. A team of researchers recently found out that the tiny dimples have a very specific, you might say, shocking function. They help dolphins detect electric currents in the water. Tim Hudner is a biologist at the Nuremberg Zoo, where he studied the dolphins. Mr. Hudner, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What made you want to take a closer look at these whiskered dimples on the snouts of dolphins?
I think there's a couple of hints that led us to do this study. There was another dolphin species, the Guyana dolphins, like a small dolphin species from South America. And for this species, it was already shown that these dimples on the rostrum, these so-called vibrissal crypts, are so-called electroreceptors, that they perceive electric fields in the water. And there was a study that compared like the morphology of those crypts of different dolphin species, including the bottlenose dolphin and the species I worked with, and then led us to investigate if bottlenose dolphins also belong to the electroreceptive group of dolphins.
So how did you go about studying this electroreception in the dolphins?
So electroreception is the ability to perceive electric fields in the water. It is very well studied in sharks and rays and also in the platypus. So we designed a behavioral experiment that was called, or the procedure that we used is called the go-no-go procedure, which is basically a little bit like when we do like a hearing test at a doctor's office, and just we get like a button in our hands to press as soon as we hear a sound on one of our ears. We basically taught the dolphins a similar way to show us that they detected these electric fields that were presented to them. So they learned, or we trained them to swim in an underwater apparatus that was built from plastic tubes. They were trained to swim in there and rest their snout in there. So they were in the same position throughout the whole study. And then we presented them with different signals at first, and they just learned to leave the station as soon as they detected anything, but stay in the station, stay in the apparatus when they didn't detect an electric field.
Now, what kind of electric field were you presenting to them?
The very first trials we did were direct current electric fields with an electric field strength of about 1 to 1.5 millivolts per centimeter. But in the end, like the weakest fields, the dolphins or two of the dolphins, Dolly and Donna, still responded to were between 3 and 5 microvolts per centimeter.
That's not a lot. So how would that correspond in nature?
Typical prey animals of dolphins, like fish, there were some studies that measured the electric field strength of these animals, and it was shown that they suit each other. So the thresholds we were able to determine for the two dolphins, they are in the same range that they, so that they are able to detect the fields generated by the fish. So each animal in the water just generates an electric field due to osmosis and nerve activity. These direct current electric fields can then be detected by the dolphins.
Well, dolphins are famous for their echolocation using sound to find prey. How would they use this electric sense?
It has been long been thought that dolphins are really acoustic specialists and only rely on their hearing and, as you say, on their echolocation ability. So their ability to detect objects and fish in the water using sound. But during foraging, all these sensory modalities have to come together. And echolocation, they can detect fish up to 100 meters away. Dolphins around the world have developed different hunting strategies. And one of these strategies that is called crater feeding involves the dolphins really digging into the sand. So head first into the sand, like they dig deep into the sediment. And in that case, they don't see very much anymore because of all the sand that is dug up. And also echolocation might be limited and can't be of any help anymore. And this is where, in our theory, electroreception comes into place. So during those last couple of centimeters, when the dolphins really, they, of course, like you said, they maybe detected a fish using echolocation that is then hidden in the sand. And then when the dolphin starts digging and can't use echolocation anymore and doesn't see anymore, electroreception might come in handy to really give them the last very important hint on where to snap and to successfully catch the fish.
Oh, I see. So the echolocation might be more for distance, finding things at a distance. And then when they get really close up, they use the electroreception to find it.
Yes.
Wow. Bottlenose dolphins have lived alongside humans for a long time, and they've been studied extensively. Were you surprised to find out something new about them?
I was really, it just fascinates me. It's more than surprise. We were, of course, hoping for this outcome of the study. We were looking for it, so we were really hoping that bottlenose dolphins are electroreceptive. But of course, for me, it was one of the main outcomes of the study, next to the ecological implications in terms of foraging and also navigation.
Dr. Hüttner, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Tim Hüttner is a biologist at the Nuremberg Zoo. The research was done in collaboration with the University of Rostock in Germany. There are thousands of seabirds on Iceland, but no human alive today has ever heard the call of one of its most famous denizens, the great auk. The auk was a penguin-like flightless bird once common in the waters of the North Atlantic, particularly around Newfoundland. But it was wiped out by the mid-1800s, before the word extinction was ever used to describe the annihilation of a species. In fact, at the time, it was inconceivable that human actions could erase a species altogether. Well, that changed after 1858, when two English scientists embarked on an expedition to Iceland to track down the great auk. What they didn't find is the subject of a new book. It's focused on our discovery of the kind of impact we can have on the other species on our planet. Dr. Gísli Pálsson is an emeritus professor of anthropology at the University of Iceland and the author of The Last of Its Kind, The Search for the Great Auk and the discovery of extinction. Hello, Dr. Paulson. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. I appreciate your invitation to speak.
First of all, tell me about the great auk. What was so great about it?
It was big. I mean, it was one of the alka family, along with puffins and others. And it was the biggest in the family, 80 centimeters big and heaviest, lots of meat. And it couldn't fly. And there were great expeditions in Newfoundland, notably, and Iceland, Norway, the Scottish Isles, and the Mediterranean. And in all places, the great auk would nest. But the biggest colony was in Newfoundland, and probably the second in Iceland. So this is where the hunting took the greatest toll, and eventually with the disappearance of the species.
Now, the great auk has been called the northern penguin. Is there any connection to the penguins in the south?
No, there's no connection with the south. It's a totally different family. They look similar, but they're very different if you look closely, and genetically it's been shown. These are different lineages, genealogically and genetically speaking.
Now, the penguins in the south are seabirds, basically. They spend a lot of time in the water. Was that also the same lifestyle of the great auk?
Yeah, they would spend most of the year in the North Atlantic Ocean, some, I guess, in the Mediterranean. But at the end of May, early June, they would lay one egg and then return once the chick was okay in the water.
Who were the two scientists who wanted to go and search for these birds in Iceland?
One of them was John Wallay. He was trained in medicine in Cambridge and Edinburgh, but he was too much of a naturalist and decided to climb mountains and visit bird colonies in Scandinavia and Iceland, etc. Unfortunately, he died a year after the Icelandic expedition from brain tumor, apparently, and it was Newton who carried the message forward, and so it's Newton that has the honor of being kind of the discoverer of extinction, in my view.
Now, you mentioned Newton. That's not Isaac Newton. I see in your book it's Alfred Newton, correct?
Yeah, there's no connection apparently with Isaac. Alfred Newton, he was of aristocratic background. People who went on expeditions were typically male and aristocrats. But Newton was trained in biology, and somehow these two guys became friends and decided to go to Iceland to look for great auks. And they had heard rumors that the species was in serious decline, and they were passionate collectors of stuffed birds and eggs, and so they decided to give it a try and headed off to Iceland.
What were they hoping to learn about the great auk on this trip back in 1858?
There wasn't much known about the great auk. That's the thing. I mean, they had several images, a few drawings, but most people who painted the bird or drew sketches hadn't seen them alive, so it was still a mystery how the bird would behave, especially in their colonies where they nested, and how they looked and their manners and how they responded to humans and whether or not they were in colonies with other birds, etc. And also the physiological makeup of the bird was relatively poorly known. So they hoped to answer all of these questions and to document also details of the history of exploitation of great auks in Iceland, but they hope to get to the skerries for themselves.
Now, you mentioned skerry. You're talking about a small rocky island, and there's a picture of it in your book, and boy, the rocks just rise straight out of the ocean. There are sheer cliffs there. It's amazing.
Yes, yes. And there were several skerries, actually, in Iceland.
So how did their search for the great auk go when Wallay and Newton finally got to Iceland?
It didn't go well. they met some intellectuals in Reykjavik and who gave them advice, and they traveled to the southern western peninsula close to where the international airport is now. And there was a renowned foreman or skippers, as we would say today, who had been to the Elday, one of the surviving hunting sites, and they negotiated with him to take them on two boats to Elday. But the foreman was a clever guy. He was skillful in reading the signs of weather and waves in the ocean. And he repeatedly called the trip off because he wouldn't risk his men. I mean, these were open, small rowing boats. And the ocean currents can be really scary close to the island. So they were unable to go there, but they would gaze in the direction of the island from the coast and eventually admitted in their diaries that they were unable to go. But instead of just giving up, they started to work as kind of anthropologists. They would sit down with the members of the last crew, which had been out to the island in 1844. And they pushed them on a number of questions, asked them to describe the bird and the results of hunting expeditions. And they were asking them to track the visits to Elday and other islands back to the earlier century. Mm. And so these documents of the interviews, they are 900 pages kept in Cambridge University Library, and it's a unique source. No other species has such a documentation of its ending, and that's why I found them fascinating. Mm-hmm.
What did they discover had happened to the last remaining great ox in Iceland?
They got descriptions of the last trip in 1844, and there were three men who went on shore. The others in the crew, 11, I think, they stayed in the boat. And they got the two birds, famously the last ones, as the saying goes, and one egg. And that's the beauty of the manuscripts, basically. It traces the last killings in Iceland. And these were the remnant couples or specimens of great auk after the killings elsewhere on Newfoundland and Scottish Isles, etc. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the great auks in Newfoundland were also heavily hunted. Did that population disappear around the same time as the great auks in Iceland?
That disappeared much earlier, almost a century earlier, I think. It was because of the hunting methods, and these were kind of industrial hunting. The birds were killed in hundreds or thousands, and this was a huge colony with thousands of birds in May, June nesting. Mm. So after that, the breeding stock was basically in Scotland and Norway and Iceland.
How did the discovery that overhunting led to the extinction of the great ox fit prevailing notions at the time of how species could come and go?
Yes, Darwin and Linnaeus, the famous taxonomist in Sweden, they assumed that extinction was either impossible or something long durée or taking place over millennia. And in Darwin's time, fossils were known and recorded. So Cuvier and many other scholars, the French master, were recognizing that there had existed species which humans had never seen. But still, Darwin wasn't interested in the possibility of extinction taking place in his time. It was Newton who insisted that extinction was occurring here and now, and that it was partly the result of human activities. And, some of the Newton's opponents said that the disappearance of the great dog was primarily a matter of natural events. But Newton insisted and tried to set the record straight. He insisted that the decline in the great dog stock or population in his time was clearly the result of overhunting. And slowly this has sort of filtered into the literature and environmental policy, although people kind of didn't recognize it at the time. So I think that Newton deserves a space in the literature and as someone who played at least a major role in the discovery of extinction. It's a bit ironic that Darwin was the master of biology, possibly the inventor of biology, and he failed to see the point. He just wasn't interested in trying to understand what was going on contemporarily. He imagined that extinction would only be seen in fossils.
How did Newton and Woolley's writings contribute to the ideas of conservation and how to protect species from this human-driven extinction?
Yeah, he was partly engaged in a dialogue with politicians. The thing is, as American historian of science has pointed out, Newton established a divide between nature and society and suggesting that one needed to make a distinction between natural events like prehistoric extinctions and social events, the results of human activities. And in making this separation, he would sort of create a space for modern zoology and biology, and a space which wasn't there before. It was all kind of fused together. So Newton was asking politicians to respect the expertise of zoologists and biologists, and it would be vital for ecological balance to listen to what the experts had to say. Prior to this, the experts weren't listened to and the expertise wasn't recognized. So having established this divide between nature and society and put science on the agenda, Newton would address British Parliament and push members of the Parliament to engage in environmental thinking and policy and kind of starting environmental governance and trying to prevent the disappearance of species. And slowly this filtered into acts for Parliament and in serious policy, which banned hunting in certain regions or certain times. So that this is basically how the news spread into policy. And it seems none of this would have happened, at least not exactly in this fashion, if Newton and Woolley hadn't ventured to Iceland to look for the last great dogs.
It sounds like Newton may have become the world's first environmentalist, at least as we know it today, someone who stands up for natural habitats and other species.
Yeah, in some sense. There were others. There was a series of scholars close in time to Newton who were advocating an environmental policy of some sort. But Newton's brilliance, if you like, was to set extinction itself on the agenda, the disappearance of species as a fact.
So what do you think Woolley and Newton would make of our biodiversity crisis and the rate of extinction that's happening in our world today?
Yeah, that's a good question. It would have been impossible for them to think about mass extinction, the Anthropocene, etc. The reports we have now from the United Nations and other agencies clearly suggest that species are on rapid decline and there are fewer and fewer species on the planet, and it's escalating. It's a crazy prognosis. It would have been difficult for Newton and Woolley to think about this. I think, in fact, Alfred Wallace, the co-discoverer of the theory of natural evolution, may have been closer to it than Darwin. He's always considered the second behind Darwin, the key guy. It seems Wallace had a better sense of environmentalism and possibly mass extinction.
Well, I can almost see them in our modern world holding their heads in their hands going, what are you doing to all these animals? They'd be aghast at what we're doing today.
Yes, Newton was writing about a few species. I mean, the case of the dodo was known, but it was poorly documented. And then he documented the case of the great auk. Newton and Wally would be stunned to learn that species were disappearing en masse all over the world and due to industrialism and global warming, etc.
So instead of saying when things disappear, it went the way of the dodo, maybe we should say they're going the way of the great auk.
Yes. Yes. The dodo was always mysterious and poorly tracked. The evidence was scant, etc. The great auk was killed in plain sight.
Dr. Paulson, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate talking to you.
Dr. Gisli Paulson is the author of The Last of Its Kind, The Search for the Great Auk and the Discovery of Extinction.
Question.
And now it's time for the Quirks and Quarks listener question.
Hello, Quirks and Quarks. This is Chris Corbett, calling from North Sydney, Nova Scotia. Lately, I've been reading that Betelgeuse might be going supernova. And since Betelgeuse is 642 light years away from Earth, does that mean that it already has gone supernova and the light is going to be reaching us in the next decade or so? Thank you very much.
And here's the answer.
Hello, I'm Dr. Jess McIver from the University of British Columbia. And I think this is a really neat question. And thinking about Betelgeuse, there has been, you know, over the last few years, some dimming. There was a study in early 2019 that the dimming of Betelgeuse might be telling us that the star was on the precipice of going supernova. But studies since then, so there was a series of images released by the European Southern Observatory late last year, so October or so, that tell us that it may actually be due to dust. The tricky thing is that it's possible that it has gone supernova, but we're just waiting, sitting on Earth like a duck in the pond, waiting for that ripple to reach us. So the way that I like to think about light in terms of how long it takes to travel to Earth from distant astrophysical sources is I like to think about it as a wave. And just like any other wave, let's say if you're standing on one side of a pond from me and you throw a rock into the pond, it's going to take some time for the wave that rock generates to travel to me. What would happen if Betelgeuse explodes, that core collapses, you're going to start to see neutrinos emitted, you're going to start to see gravitational waves emitted, and it will take a while actually for the light to break out of the exterior layer of this collapsing star. The first sign that we would have that Betelgeuse has gone supernova is the arrival of the gravitational waves and the neutrinos. And it's going to take them potentially 600 years to make their way to us. That'll be the first clear sign that a supernova has happened. So it's possible. There's no way to know until one of those messengers reaches us. The gravitational waves, the neutrinos, and then some hours later, we would see that telltale bright, bright light in the sky.
Dr. Jess McIver is an astronomer at the University of British Columbia. And that's it for Quirks and Quarks this week. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email is quirks@cbc.ca. Or just go to the contact link on our webpage at cbc.ca/quirks. where you can read my latest blog or listen to our audio archives. You can also follow our podcast or get us on the CBC Listen app. It's free from the App Store or Google Play. Quirks and Quarks is produced by Olsi Sorokina, Mark Crawley, Rosie Fernandez, Amanda Buckowitz, and Sonia Biting. Our senior producer is Jim Lebbins. I'm Bob McDonald. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.